Seb, great to see you again. Great to have you back on a podcast of mine. Welcome.
Ah, and Jake, honestly, it's such a pleasure. Like you and I were just chatting before, we've recorded a podcast a long time ago, a few years back, and I've really enjoyed the conversation. So I'm looking forward to chatting.
And it's fun to see the progress as well. I mean, certainly the progress I've seen in yourself. And we'll go through that today. What is the hidden cost of money?
I would say that for the average individual, when we think about money, we think of it as just a medium of exchange, something we use to go and purchase things. But we don't think about all of the unintended consequences of how money impacts us as individuals. And so the hidden cost of money to me is how money weaves its influence into us as individuals, how it impacts our psychology, how it impacts how we show up, how it impacts our relationships, and also the repercussions of that, how it impacts our environment, how it impacts our business, politics, you name it. And so to me, money is so much more than just this thing we interact with to go and purchase things. Money really is, it's a way we communicate. And when it is broken, it leads to a whole heap of issues, which I would argue are the issues that we're facing in society today.
And let's dive into some of those issues. So what would be, if you were to give two or three things that have obviously happened to you personally due to the hidden costs of money?
For sure. So you know what? I would say if I take a step back for a second and then I connect the dots between like psychology
and
money, that allows you to then kind of put yourself in this framework where you're like, huh, I can now understand why people are behaving in a certain way. And so when I think about money, one of the things you start to recognize is that, so in Bitcoin, we talk about this thing called time preference. People that aren't familiar with what time preference is, you can think of it as a spectrum. On one end of the spectrum, a high time preference, you're focused on your impulsive immediate needs. I want to meet whatever it is that I feel like doing right now. I'm in survival mode. I'm in the here and now. And then you have low time preference, the other end of the spectrum, which is I'm focused on security, building security for the long term. I'm focused on building a life that I want to live and thinking about prosperity. And so you're looking out into the future and you're mapping, you're planning. And so there's a big difference between this low time preference and this high time preference. Now, what is interesting is that when money breaks down, when money starts losing purchasing power, all of a sudden life becomes harder. Our cost of living starts to rise. And so all of a sudden, if we're stuck focusing on survival, we're being very impulsive. And so money, when it loses value, shifts us from this kind of like low time preference. Who am I? How do I want to show up? What is it that I value? And how do I want to build a future for myself? To this, I need to get food on the table and a roof over my head. And so money starts to shape how we're showing up, whether we're high time preference or low time preference. That's the first section. The second is meaninglessness. You can see in society today that we've just got widespread anxiety, widespread depression, widespread drug use. People don't have meaning. And I would argue that one of the big reasons why is because if you want to be able to find meaning in your life, you want to be able to plan. You want to be able to think about some future state. Well, what about if you want to go and buy a house? Well, if you think that it's going to take you 10 years to save for a house, and then 2 years into that saving, now it's going to take 20 years. It's very easy for meaninglessness to set in because we have no control over our future. We have no control or foresight into what may happen because it's just becoming harder and harder. And so today we have just widespread meaninglessness because of the fact that it's really hard to predict when money is losing value so quickly and our cost of living and our ability to thrive is just becoming further and further out of reach. And it's interesting because in psychology, there's this idea of our locus of control. And that is, do I believe that I have governance over my trajectory and my path? Or do I believe that I'm just at the whim of what's happening and I don't really have much control? And there's countless studies that highlight that people that don't believe they have much control have lower health outcomes, lower life expectancy, higher rates of like allergies, depression, anxiety again. And so you start to realize that money is shaping how we are. It's impacting us on a health basis, not just on kind of a mental basis or a monetary basis. And then the final thing that I'll just mention is this idea of kind of compassion and altruism. And what's interesting in psychology, again, you've got Maslow's hierarchy of needs, this kind of five-tier pyramid. At the base of that pyramid, you have your survival needs, food and shelter. It's really hard to move up that pyramid into things like relationships, into spirituality, into self-actualization, if we have not met our basic needs of food and shelter. And so when we are fearful, when we're struggling to survive, our aperture of awareness starts to narrow and we're just focused on meeting those basic needs. And so that's the world we live in today. So it's something like 74% of people live paycheck to paycheck between the States and Canada. And I'm sure that is even worse in many other developing nations. And so these people are just trying to survive. And that leaves them very little capacity to look externally and think about compassion and altruism, giving back to their communities. And so tying together like money and psychology is really important. And so when you're asking about like, what is something that I have noticed about money on me, is that money really impacts how we consume and how we show up in life. And so when we're living under a fiat world where money is losing value, it's really easy to fall into the tendency of consumption. Hey, I'm going to be happy when I just purchase this next thing. I'm going to be happy if I just get the new watch, or I'm just trying to meet these immediate needs that fulfill my impulsive desires. Whereas as I've moved over to Bitcoin, you start thinking long term, you start thinking about building security, and all of a sudden you're rewarded for saving because your purchasing power increases. And so consumption habits start to dwindle and you think about saving, and that therefore has less of an impact on the environment and such. So that's a bit of a roundabout answer to your question, but I think it's profound when you start tying money to psychology, money to how we show up as individuals.
It is profound. And the journey that is Bitcoin is profound itself. Of that, I've no doubt, purely because of the experience myself. It's just, I mean, to say, right, okay, we recorded a couple of years ago. Let's just, for sake of argument, say it was roughly Q3, Q4 of 2022. FTX is going bust. Celsius is already gone. BlockFi is already gone. Bitcoin is dead. And it was at like $20,000 breaking into like the mid-teens. And people are like, yeah, it's going to be 10 grand, 5 grand a coin. Now, that never quite happened. In my opinion, the market overcorrected. And in hindsight, that was an unbelievable time to buy Bitcoin. And I just happened to be in a position where that's what I was doing at that time because of decisions I'd made 2 years before that. And so my average buy prices as a result of that like trough in, you know, price action, I was getting Bitcoin much cheaper than I ever expected to. What's happened since then is obviously it's like, it's just the purchasing power has like doubled, tripled, quadrupled to the average purchase price. You're like, whoa, what is this thing? And as that's happened, my psychology has changed and I'm a different person. And one thing that's really fascinating that's happening to me on a very personal level lately is people extremely close to me. Just to share with you. So one of the things from the Bitcoin Standard that I loved was the historical context of what happened when China and India stayed on a silver standard and others moved to a gold standard. And the difference in progress of those places as a result of a different choice of money was like a stark erosion of capital versus like huge growth. And that's actually happening in my very, very close life. It's like different money standards in the home are making different choices and different progress outcomes. And some people don't like that. And it's really hard, but it's all about psychology because I'm happier. I have a better outlook on the future. I have more confidence on the future. And all those things that you mentioned tie in. So it wasn't roundabout in the slightest. It's brilliant context for what is, I think, the most compelling conversation.
Well, and I'll add something to what you're saying, which is where I live in Canada, I live in the Sea to Sky Highway, which is just north of Vancouver. And unfortunately, because it's a desirable place to live, we have Whistler, the ski resort, we have the mountains, the cost of living is so incredibly high. And so you have this whole group of the population that unfortunately, no one's having kids. It's too expensive to have kids. Wow. And we're seeing this not just in this area, we're seeing it all over the world. Canada's childbirth rate is falling off a cliff. It's the same with Australia. It's the same with global birth rates are falling off a cliff because when life is hard, and again, as I mentioned, when our aperture of awareness focuses on survival, we don't think about long-term. So as a result, people are having less kids. And what's interesting is you step into the world of Bitcoin, and what do you see? A whole bunch of Bitcoiners posting relatively frequently, hey, a new kid's on the way. Hey, we just had a kid. And so it's really fascinating to see this shift where as money starts breaking down, people stop thinking about the future. As they stop thinking about the future, they stop thinking about family. They stop thinking about relationships. They're focused on survival. In the world of Bitcoin, it's the reverse. People are having more time to look inwards. They have more capacity. They have more time to really answer the questions about like, who am I and what actually motivates me? What is it that I really value? And what people are recognizing is that what I really value is relationships and community and family. And so we're starting to see that in the world of Bitcoin. More people are having kids. More people are trying to build a family, a legacy. And I just think it's a profound shift that we're seeing take place in Bitcoin.
It's so cool, isn't it? And we have yet to meet in person. We will. I'm absolutely confident of that. But the physical conferences and meetups, et cetera, that you can go to in different parts of the world are a petri dish of the future of the world. So how does that make you feel from the study that you've done? Like, how confident are you that that statement's true?
Oh, man. Like, you know what? Increasingly, I have noticed that, to me, Bitcoin is a spiritual tool. This may sound super out there, but I think
that go for it.
As money is breaking down, we're becoming so hyper-fixated on money for survival that we're just becoming so disconnected to everything else. There's a reason why one of the biggest industries in the world is the financial industry. It's because when money breaks down, people need to go and protect their purchasing power. They need to go invest. They need to figure out ways to try and outpace inflation. And the reality is that if we just had a money that allowed us to save, that actually captured advancements in technology and productivity so prices actually fell over time, life would start to get easier. People would actually stop thinking about money because in the end, money is just a means to be able to transact and express what it is that we value. And so I think that what's really fascinating is that to me, money is a spiritual tool and Bitcoin is kind of the apex of that because ironically, when we start living on a Bitcoin standard, even though it is digital money, it gets us to stop thinking about money. It actually gets us to start thinking more about how we want to show up. And so these, to your point, like these conferences have been profound because you turn up to these places. And if I turned up to a finance conference, it would be 30 to 60 year olds, typically white males. And then you can turn up to a Bitcoin conference and it's anyone from tiny, tiny kids, newborns, all the way up to kind of elderly people, every single nation state, religion, you name it. And it's just people that have like a lust for life and they care about building a world which they want their kids to live in. And so it's these people that are thinking long term. They're not just thinking about meeting their immediate needs. And to me, I just think it's a profound experience going to any of these Bitcoin conferences.
I totally agree. And what's been cool, obviously, is since we spoke, you released your book, The Hidden Cost of Money. And as soon as I saw it come out, I was like, purchase, read it, loved it. And I think what was fun is, I'm probably like 50 Bitcoin books in at this stage, roughly, on top of all the podcasts and everything else, articles, etc. I don't think anyone had taken such a good holistic approach to the experience that has been learning about what sound money actually is. And in particular, wanted to ask you about was health. And I had some great conversations with other people on podcasts about the impact of money in relation to your health. But some of the things that you drew on in the book really hit home. And in particular, references to people like Gabor Mate, who has done amazing work around trauma and what that actually means. So just run us through, like, first of all, becoming an author, why did you do it? And then I'd love to spend some time picking through like why health came up as a big part of the book.
For sure. No, that's an awesome question. And I think that for me, I would say that I never expected to become an author. I ended up going down this rabbit hole of I've always been passionate about education. I was a backcountry mountain bike guide for a long, long time. I used to teach a lot. I've worked in the school system before, and I've always appreciated supporting people in their learning journey. And alongside this whole journey, I realized pretty early on in my late teenage years, I was like, if I'm earning $15 an hour, $20 an hour, how am I ever going to be able to afford to raise a family? How am I ever going to be able to go and purchase the house? And that led me down the investing rabbit hole. And we spoke about this on your previous podcast briefly. It led me down this investing rabbit hole of trying to create passive income. And as I went down that rabbit hole further and further and further, it really opened my eyes to the fact that I thought we were in a free market and we very much are not in a free market. And so from that, obviously, I found Bitcoin and I realized that, hey, I believe Bitcoin is this key, this puzzle piece that brings us back into alignment with the natural state of things. It's a monetary system that actually aligns with a free market. And so it profoundly changed me as an individual. And so I felt compelled to just start writing about the impact of our monetary system on the world around us, the hidden cost of our money. And that led me to writing more and more about Bitcoin. And I noticed there was a common thread in all of my articles that I wrote. And that was that money is impacting all of these different areas of how we show up. And so by the time I actually ended up writing The Hidden Cost of Money, I'd written probably 20 long form article posts. I'd started the Looking Glass Education, which is a kind of platform all about free education for the layperson. And so I had all of this material. And so it kind of felt just like a natural progression. It wasn't something that I was like, I'm going to write a book and I'm going to write a book about this. It just felt like this natural progression. And for me, in my journey, I think I came at it not from a finance economic background, because I didn't study finance or economics. Instead, as someone who has spent a lot of time in the mountains, I've always been very conscious of my health. And health isn't just the food at which you put in your body. Health includes trauma and stress and how we're showing up on a spiritual level. And so I'd always done a lot of research into those areas. And at one point, I wanted to become a therapist. And so I went down, I studied for quite a few years to become a therapist, and then realized, I think I've got enough trauma of my own. I don't know if I'm ready to go and help people in their own journey. But through going down that path, it opened my eyes again just to how much the external stresses we face impact our physical health. And so that's where I felt in my book, The Hidden Cost of Money, one aspect or topic that I really needed to touch on was this connection between how money starts to impact us as individuals. And what is interesting is that, and this was profound when I started reading about this, is that before we're even born, the external environment is starting to shape us. So our mum, if our mum, while we're inside her womb, is facing immense amounts of stress, well, that stress is going to obviously be converted into cortisol, adrenaline, epinephrine, and that baby is going to be flooded with those stress hormones. Now, what is interesting is that baby is right in its prime development. It is developing and about to enter into this world, and it's facing all of these stress hormones. What that means is that if it's flooded with stress hormones and it enters this world with a hypersensitive nervous system, which is very frequent, all of a sudden that baby can be stuck in fight, flight, or freeze, these stress response systems. Now, it's interesting because take freeze, for instance. Freeze, our evolutionary tendency to try and escape scary situations, is from, let's say I'm on the plains of Africa and a lion comes up to me, and all of a sudden I know that I can't outrun, so I go into freeze, evolutionary stress response system. Well, it lowers my heart rate, it lowers my breathing rate, it stops my digestion, all in the goal of trying to minimize the chance of me being seen and maximize my chance of survival. But if a baby is entering this world stuck in freeze because it's been flooded with stress hormones, well, now it's going to have lower digestion. It's not going to be gaining nutrients from its food. It's going to have lower blood flow. It's going to have health issues. It's going to struggle when it starts elevating its heart rate. It's going to have sleep issues. It's going to have like a whole bunch of just basically potential allergies, you name it. And what are we seeing in society? We're seeing this exact same thing. Now, what is really interesting is, what is the number one stressor globally? Well, the number one stressor globally is money. It's the number one stressor by far. Something like 65% of people face monetary stress. So you're saying that like this thing that we're all facing is triggering these huge stress responses in a woman's body. So before we even enter in this world, we're already flooded by hormones as a result of our mum facing monetary stress. And then once we go and enter this world, okay, cool. Maybe we've made it through that and our mum wasn't too stressed. But then the issue is our parents are having to go out and work to put a roof over our heads. What we've seen in Canada is, because of the rising cost of living, we've seen a doubling of dual earner households and a halving of single earner households. Households can't survive on a single income anymore. They need both parents having to go out and work. So, okay, we've made it through all of this stressful experience of kind of being born. And then all of a sudden, both of our parents are having to go out and work, which means we're not being supported by our parents. They're not meeting our emotional needs to the same extent. And we're spending more time with our peers. What's interesting, because when we spend time with our peers, we're exploring the world on the same page. We're not getting that culture. We're not getting that knowledge. We're not getting those moral values passed down to us to the same extent. Instead, we want to fit in. So we want to look the same. We want to sound the same. We want to dress the same. So you end up with a culture with no identity. Kids don't know themselves. They don't know what it is that they value. They don't have morals. And this is what we're seeing in society again. And so I would say that money is profoundly shaping the world in which we live in, from before we're even born to entering into this world, impacting our relationships, how we're showing up, our parents' ability to meet our emotional needs and pass down knowledge. And so this is where, when you enter into the world of Bitcoin, it's the inverse of this. That kid is developing in a healthier system with less stress hormones. And then by the time they enter this world, the parents have more capacity, because they're in a better financial position. They're able to support their kids' emotional needs more. They're able to pass down knowledge. They're able to pass down culture. They're able to pass down moral values. So you end up with these kids that they have a self-identity. They can move into a social network, into a new crowd. And if a kid puts them down, they don't respond with just like, oh, I need to kind of fit in and conform. They respond with who they are and what they value. And so I think you end up with a healthier society. And so to me, money is just, it's just been this like profound journey diving into the impact of money, society, psychology, relationships. And for me, the last point I'll make is that it really hit home because I was raised by a single mum. My parents separated when I was 5 years old. And when I look back, my mum did her absolute best to be able to support us. And she had to work kind of 6 days a week. She was worked her ass off to try and put a roof over our heads. And so my mum wasn't able to meet our emotional needs to the extent that she might have wanted to because of the financial pressures of being a single mum. And so money really does impact us. It impacts us all.
Oh my gosh. It's hard to know where to take the conversation after listening to such a succinct explanation as to why this is an important subject. Something that comes to mind is this like charade that is money in the status quo, which is like there's a political party that's supposedly in power. There's the chancellor or whoever the head of business is who steps up with his red briefcase or whatever. And he's like, here's the budget and trust the experts, guys. We've got your back. Or there's some kind of like suited central banker that's like, we've done this with the interest rate because we believe that X, Y, Z. And it's like, we got this, guys. Don't worry. You know, it's just something that you use. Just carry on as if, you know, nothing's happened. And when you start asking these kind of questions, and in particular, the three original frames that you use are so good, which is time preference, like meaninglessness, or that as a result of it, and compassion. Now, those are three subjects that people would happily talk about, especially if it wasn't to do with money. So it's always fun, I think, when you get a book like how you wrote The Hidden Cost of Money, where it's like, let's talk a lot about the problems and see what thread comes out. And I equally love that idea of like, if you're going to write, just start writing, mm-hmm. you know, and your three articles become five articles, become 20, become, oh, do you know what? This actually makes sense as a book. So one thing I would say personally that I've done, which is different to before, is so we've got three kids under the age of five. And thus far, we have homeschooled them. Now, homeschooling is not bringing school home, something I've learned. It's basically just lots of time with your primary caregivers. Like it's just playing in the playground or walking around or whatever. And because I'm able to control my time more, I'm able to be at home a lot more than my father was, for example. And even as an 8-year-old, I then, you know, was shipped off to a boarding school, which is a whole nother discussion. But like, Gabor Mate would be someone to say this, like the first 7 years are the most formative years of a child's life. So what's fun here is this idea that no one doesn't care about the health of our children. You know what I mean? It's like, mm-hmm. do you care about the health of children? Yes or no? Well, you should probably ask the question, what is money? Do you care about the health of your own child? Probably ask the question, what is money? And some people don't. So why is that, do you think? There's this kind of like sense of disinterest in learning, maybe, or maybe the problem that they have just isn't acute enough. Like, I don't know. Please take it from there if you can, Seb. Like, anything come out of that for you?
You know what? It's a really challenging question to answer because I very much believe, like, I tend to have this belief that I don't believe there's malicious people in this world. I think everyone is trying to do the best with the information they've got. Mm. And even when you think about these people throughout history, Mao, Kim Il-sung, these people that have been at the head of heinous, heinous crimes, I would even argue, and from reading a lot of Gabor Mate, that this comes from trauma. They themselves have been through such immense trauma that what they believe they're doing is right. I don't agree with it. I don't condone it as an individual. But in their mind, they've managed to persuade themselves they're doing something for the bigger purpose, the long term, and they believe it is right. And so I think that I don't believe that people are inherently malicious. And along those same lines, I think that everyone is trying to do the best they can with the information they've got. And so what is challenging is that I think that when money starts to break down, people have less time and capacity. And when they have less time and capacity, they have less ability to think about the information which they're consuming. And it's interesting, there's a book called The Psychology of Totalitarianism. And I talk about it in my book, That Didn't Cost a Money. And it talks about how there's kind of like these four stages to totalitarianism. The first stage is loneliness. And it is when, as an individual, we're working so hard because life is tough and the cost of living is rising that we don't have the capacity to go out and socialize to the extent we might want to. The second stage is meaninglessness. Again, it's kind of what we were talking about earlier, where we're working so hard, but because life is so tough, and maybe I'm stuck in a job, a dead-end job that isn't really satisfying me, I don't really feel like I've got purpose, that there's kind of this meaninglessness to it. The third stage is widespread anxiety, which is because you're not really finding meaning in life, you're also feeling lonely. All of a sudden, you're getting this widespread anxiety, but you don't really have anything to attach that anxiety to. That's a difference to fixed anxiety, which is I may be standing on the edge of a cliff right now. Well, the anxiety is because I'm scared of heights and there's a cliff in front of me. So the moment I remove myself from the cliff, that anxiety is going to drop. Widespread anxiety, you don't know what's causing the anxiety because it's just so widespread and kind of prolific that you don't know how to remove yourself from the situation. And then finally, there's kind of like aggression. And that is once loneliness, meaninglessness, and widespread anxiety kind of kick in, all of a sudden, if someone is able to, a leader, a dictator is able to create an entity at which they are able to make up a narrative for which is causing this anxiety, you start to see aggression throughout society and people are willing to kind of form that mob mentality. And what's interesting during these experiences or these times when you go and research them is that many times people are willing to push aside their beliefs just to conform and fit in. They're so scared. They don't feel like they can think for themselves. And when we have that limited capacity, we're not able to research to the same extent. We're not able to consciously think about the information we're consuming. And so I think, like, to your question, it's a bit of a roundabout way of answering, is that I think when money breaks down, we have less capacity to question the monetary system at which we're living under. And on top of that, I think there's it may not be intentional, but our monetary system is so convoluted that you just need to look at even the highest economic professors can have an argument on what they think quantitative easing is and whether something is quantitative easing or isn't quantitative easing, which shows you that we've got a very obscure system. It's not black or white. And that's what I really like about something like Bitcoin, is that it's so simplistic. There's a simple set of rules. And anyone, if you dig into it for a handful of hours, you may not understand all the repercussions of it, but you can understand Bitcoin. And so I think a simplistic system gives people the capacity to understand it and make up their own decisions. Whereas a current system, unfortunately, we've created an environment where because we have limited capacity, we put off all of our decision-making onto others. I can't figure this out myself, so I'm going to put off the decision-making onto economists. And we also see that not only play out in money, but almost in every other aspect of life. When it comes to health, health is so complex, I'm just going to put off my decision-making onto the doctor. Oh, when it comes to education, it's too complex, there's too many subjects, I'm going to put my decision-making off onto the teacher. Oh, when it comes to you name it, we're putting off our decision-making onto some so-called expert. And so people today have very little knowledge of kind of this puzzle that is the world. And I think that at the moment you start studying, the moment you start reading books, you realize it's not as complex as it's made out to be.
Awesome. And one of the bit more context into what I've been up to in a sense, Seb, is so this reimagined podcast is around my name, just Jake Woodhouse. And there's a number of reasons for that, but and to share some of them. So first of all, super long-term plan. I want to do this for the next 10, 20 years, talk to interesting people. Like, what an awesome thing to get the chance to do. And with that, I would like the ability to roam anywhere in terms of subjects. Like, whatever comes up is okay. And I think that's going to be really cool. But just from an investment perspective, which is really the original use case that I came to Bitcoin for, I guess, evolved. And I now think about kind of capital allocation, if you want to call it that. So you've got financial capital, human capital, and you've got intellectual capital. And if you don't have strong allocations in the human and the intellectual, you can't generate financial returns. So in some ways, the financial plays second fiddle to the other two. But obviously, human capital, if you're not having more kids, then you're not creating human capital. You've got no like labor, you've got no ideas, you've got no creativity. And there's other areas to the human capital as well. And then intellectual is obviously investing in yourself. for example, going on the writing journey that you have, the wealth of wisdom you've accumulated, but also I'm sure the opportunities that have come from it, like there's an ROI there. And you can start to think as an investor across these three buckets, like how am I actually doing and what progress is being made, and hold yourself accountable to that. But one of the reasons I'm even able to think like this is through the choice of adopting a sound money standard. And I now have a large allocation in my portfolio to simply money. And this is a type of money that has the ability to save. So yes, I'm using the investment lens to make other decisions. It's actually not, I'm not stock picking, you know, I'm not going out and finding like a niche classic car. I'm certainly not real estate investing. And that's really fun to me to think through. So a lot of what you talk about here is because of avoiding the hidden costs of money, in a sense. And so to ask yourself then, like, what are some of the opportunities that come out of the intellectual capital that you've invested into and becoming an author? How do you think through some of the decisions that you make?
It's one point I'll quickly make on kind of what you're saying that I do think is, to me, it's really kind of stood out as I've gone down this kind of monetary history rabbit hole, is that naturally the environment we live in is deflationary. And what I mean by that is that prices should fall over time, because as a society, as individuals, since the dawn of time, since we're hunter-gatherers, we have always been trying to improve efficiency, improve productivity, create tools that allow us to get more for less. And so prices should fall. And the analogy that I use all the time, but I think it's just a perfect analogy, is just like Netflix versus Blockbuster. Like, you think about Blockbuster and having to go down to Blockbuster, spend half an hour in Blockbuster, figure out which movie you want to watch, and then rent the movie, drive all the way back home again, drive back down to Blockbuster. All that time and energy to rent one movie. And now for almost the same cost, you're able to basically have Netflix with a million movies at your fingertips. And so prices should be falling. But because we're printing more money at a faster rate than prices should be falling, we don't experience that. And so I think that what is interesting is that we should be able to, as a society, experience falling prices and simply save in the currency. But instead, we're pushed to invest. And there's a big difference between investing and saving. We have a society that we cannot save these days.
That was such a big penny drop moment. Like, investing and saving are not the same thing. So what do you mean? I don't even know that there was an option to save. Like, it's that
100%.
It's that big a deal.
Yeah. And like, maybe I have a good friend who, she inherited £100,000 from her parents her grandparents, when I think her grandparents passed away. And she inherited this about 10 years ago. And since then, it sat in her bank account. And what's interesting, she lives where I live here in Canada, and house prices have tripled during that same time. So if house prices have tripled during that same time, it's effectively as if that £100,000 is now worth £33,000. Yeah, so it's just like, you're just seeing your purchasing power absolutely decimated when you're trying to save. And so I think what's fascinating is, under a world where we have a monetary system that aligns with the natural deflationary state of things, where prices should be falling, I think that all of a sudden saving becomes viable again. And if saving becomes viable again, we don't have to spend all of this time analyzing where best should I put my money? What risks are involved in this? We don't have to take immense amounts of risk. We're able to simply save. And so I think that that would honestly just be one of the biggest shifts in society if we were able to just simply store our purchasing power in the currency, and at least it would stay stable, if not increase in purchasing power. And I think that for me, what I've noticed is that when I was able to remove all of this real estate in my mind from spending time thinking about investing to just being like, hey, you know what? I just put my purchasing power in Bitcoin. That's all I need to do. I don't have to think about anything else. I just had so much more capacity for everything else in life. I had more capacity to read books to learn about the world around me. I had more capacity to dive into my friendships and my relationships. I had more capacity to really look inwards and deepen my relationship with myself and how I show up as individuals. And so I think that Bitcoin, or just saving in a currency that allows your capacity to increase over time, just has profound impact on intellectual capacity, spiritual capacity, you name it. And it's, I just think it's one of the coolest things about Bitcoin is, again, it's not about money. It's about how do we show up more authentically? And that's what money allows us to do when it allows us to simply save.
And that's one of the fun things about that super simple statement, which is Bitcoin is just money. But if you haven't studied what money is, then of course you can't see that for what it is. One thread that we didn't quite catch from your last answer, but the opportunities. So having decided to invest in yourself intellectually, what have come out of that?
So I would say, and this is maybe like diving back a little more like spiritually, is that I believe the world always gives us what it is that we need to grow. But the problem is when we are constantly pressured to survive, and I've mentioned this a few times, our aperture of awareness narrows. And so it's really hard to be able to see these little flags that are popping up or these little opportunities that are popping up when we're very limited in our capacity. And so what I've noticed in my own personal life is that as I've gone down this Bitcoin rabbit hole and as I've had more capacity, I've started to really feel as if I'm able to see these opportunities that are arising in front of me. And I'm not just head down, just like, how do I make money to put food on the table? How do I make money to try and at least build somewhat of a future? Because otherwise it's going to be incredibly hard. And now with this capacity, I'm able to see like, huh, this is a really interesting opportunity. I think I'm going to take that. Even though I don't know what the return may be right now, it's allowed me to dive into things that maybe don't have initial clarity. And they've unfolded into some of the most profound experiences. Like I would never have been able to anticipate that from five, six years ago, when I entered into kind of the Bitcoin space, I entered in purely from this perspective of, hey, number go up technology, Bitcoin is an investment, and hopefully it's going to ease my life in the future because it's going to increase in purchasing power, to all of a sudden speaking on the world stage at these conferences, to being invited on podcasts such as yourself, to writing a book, to being able to interact with nation state individuals and talk about Bitcoin. Like it has been one of the most profound experiences.
Awesome.
And it's because I believe that when you have more capacity, you can lean into going with the flow. Whereas when you have limited capacity, it's really hard to lean into going with the flow because it's like, I got to focus on survival here. I got to figure out how I'm going to get the next paycheck to put food on the table. And so to me, that I would say is one of the biggest things.
So cool. And so for people listening out there, this is possible. Now, obviously, everyone's different, i.e. the net wealth that you turn up with the day that you realize Bitcoin's a good idea, everyone's different. Equally, the expenses that you have, everyone's different. So, of course, there's going to be a different rate at which you are able to reclaim your time, or there's going to be a different rate at which, you know, you might feel like you're more secure financially, etc. But that's what's cool about it, though. It's a set of cards, in a sense, that you have to play them the best you can. And this is a trump card that if you get dealt it, you're like, oh my gosh. And just everything starts to get a bit easier around you. Okay, so if we hold a high probability that the Bitcoin ecosystem and the people that, you know, describe themselves as Bitcoiners are a snapshot of the future, like the creativity that's about to be unleashed is mind-bendingly big. And so when we study parts of history, such as the Renaissance, for example, of course, that was heavily connected to a period of sound money when you actually start picking these bits apart. And equally, the rise of Rome before, obviously, then the fall of Rome. So what gets you really pumped about, you know, the next 5, 10, 15 years? And what is the right time frame to think about the adoption of Bitcoin for everyday people, but also just like those that are interested in entrepreneurship and creativity and going out and like building a vision? Because to me, it's very, very exciting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I think this is such a good question. And it's such a tough one to answer just because I think there's a lot of speculation as to what this world looks like. And I think that the challenge is that there's a famous saying in investing, which is the market can stay irrational for the longer than you can stay solvent. And I think that the challenge is that I think the fiat system is on its last legs, but it can go on for quite a bit longer than we think it can go.
It can do more marathons than you think. Yeah. Oh,
100%. It's going to have a few more kind of like adrenaline pumps and just kind of keep limping along. And so, but I think that what is really interesting is that when it comes to Bitcoin, when it comes to money, in my book, I touch on kind of like four main areas, which is kind of like relationships, kind of the parent-child bond, which we've kind of touched on. We touched on the environment very, very briefly. I touch on politics and kind of governance, and then I touch on business. And so if I go over these very, very quickly, this is kind of what I think is profound about living on something such as the Bitcoin standard. So when it comes to the parenting, as purchasing power increases, parents are going to have more capacity. They're passing down much more knowledge. So I think we're going to have a much more cohesive, culturally relevant society, which is what we're losing right now. Now, what about like the environment? Well, I think it's really fascinating right now because our purchasing power is decreasing. We're incentivized to consume because our purchasing power is greatest in the present moment. Well, that's impacting our environment because naturally when we consume, that consumes resources. So it's impacting our waterways, it's impacting our forests, it's impacting kind of the minerals out of the ground, you name it. Well, the opposite is true on Bitcoin. If we're incentivized to save as opposed to consume because our purchasing power is growing, well, then all of a sudden we're going to have a society that is spending much more time looking inwards as opposed to looking outwards to try and meet their needs through consumption. Well, that's going to reduce the strain on our natural environment, our forests, our waterways, the minerals in our ground. So I think that we're going to start to see a healing or repairing of the damage that we're doing to our natural environment. That, I think, is just, to me, I think that is huge. And on top of that, I think we're going to see if less capital is going towards consumption, well, that means less dollars are going towards businesses that are creating crappy products. Well, if there's less dollars going towards these businesses, you increase competition, the quality of product rises. And with the quality of product rising, you're also going to see a boost in innovation. You're going to see a boost in creativity, as you're talking about. So I think that with less dollars going towards these businesses, anyone who's being fiscally irresponsible or creating products that don't really offer value, they're just going to wither away. We're going to see the companies that stay are the ones that are going to really be offering value, and they're able to think about their customers' needs from a different level. And then when it comes to kind of the governance and kind of the politics side of things, well, I think the challenge right now is that because the government has a money printer, it can operate and fund operations without support from the populace. Governments right now, taxation is not the only thing that's funding government. They're able to fund operations through quantitative easing and all of these other forms of kind of intervention. And so I think that if you're able to separate money and state, such as with Bitcoin, the government becomes a business just like any other business. And so the only way for it to thrive is to offer value to its populace. And so it switches the incentive. Instead of the government being able to operate without support from the populace, the government can only operate with support from the populace. So it has to create value. So I think that it changes our whole thoughts around governance and politics, where we create a value for value collaborative model. Because if it doesn't offer value, it's going to wither away because it's not obtaining capital. And then finally, on the business side of things, the challenge right now we see is that because the government is intervening monetarily and they're injecting capital into the economy anytime we have instability, it's creating this support for fiscal irresponsibility. If you're a company and you're being fiscally irresponsible and then you get bailed out, what does that tell you? It means you don't have to run those safety buffers of saving. You don't have to be able to think about the long-term prospects because if you get in trouble, cool, you're just going to be bailed out. And so I think that we start to see a shift in incentives towards companies have to think long-term because if they don't think long-term and something pops up that is unexpected, they're just going to have to wither away because they're fiscally irresponsible. And I think one thing that's really interesting is in today's world and specifically during the pandemic, Canada wanted to intervene and support people that had kind of taken a big hit from the kind of loss of job or because of the pandemic. And so if you had lost 10% of your income or more, you were entitled to something called the Canadian Emergency Response Benefit. And this was $2,000 a month. And so Canadians were given $24,000 a year if they'd lost more than 10% of their income. What does that do? It's a totally misaligned incentive because 30% of Canadians earn under that amount of money. So you've basically just said to 30% of Canadians, hey, do you want to go and work full-time for your money or do you just want to get given it for free from the government? So of course they take the latter option. And then you just saw this huge swath of the population just quit. And so all of these small businesses were no longer able to find low-income workers. And so whether it was bike shops, whether it was cafes, whether it was restaurants, all of these low-income workers, these mom and pop shops, they couldn't find workers and they went under. And so in the end, all of these big multinational corporations that could tap into a lot of these alternative funding methods, they were able to thrive while the small businesses withered away. And so I think that when you separate money from state, you realign the incentives towards value creation. Companies have to offer value because if they don't, they wither away. And so you end up with a society that is creating so much more value. You have so much more cohesiveness. and connection and collaboration and value creation. And so it really does impact our relationships, it impacts our environment, it impacts our business and politics, governance, you name it. I think it is profound what the future looks like under such a standard.
And hence, the biggest, I'll use a different phrase, the most important vote that you have is with your money. So if you're out there listening and you've just listened to Seb describe brilliantly like the different areas of our life that are going to change as a result of the adoption of sound money, then the best way to actually make that happen is to make changes. So if you own things that are still denominated in fiat, still controlled by the system that you grew up with, then you're still supporting it by keeping those things. And it's not until you decide to sell and move your economic energy, for another phrase, into the Bitcoin ecosystem, nothing's necessarily going to actually change, or it will just take longer. So like, you know, going and voting at the polls for whatever politician is a complete waste of your time in comparison to what you might be able to do with your own asset allocation, should you, you know, be lucky to have one. Obviously, you've already mentioned that 75% of Americans and Canadians are literally paycheck to paycheck. So, you know, we're still only talking about a quarter of the population in that sense. One area I'd love to work on a little more before we hit up on the hour, Seb, is the environment. And I know it's something you're passionate about, where you're based, et cetera, and having spent so much time in the mountains over the years. In 2017, 2018, was focused on angel investing in clean tech startups. And I was consuming a lot of information around climate change. And now that I look back at my library of books, it's kind of amusing in a way, because I was very clear on like how important carbon was. And if an investment didn't align with the view of the world I wanted to see, then it just didn't make sense. I had a very high bar for what I thought was an appropriate, you know, set of values that you needed to have. And the reason that Bitcoin hit me like a ton of bricks, or one of the reasons, was the idea that, hang on a second, what if it's the money? And if you change the money, what does that mean? Well, the incentive to consume today drops. And that concept of time preference, it really hit hard. Because you're like, hang on, so what am I currently doing? I'm currently betting on technology companies that all have hockey stick growth potential. And no one in the sustainability world was talking about the elephant in the room, which was consumption. So even if you have a clothing brand that supposedly makes its shit better, or you have anything, frankly, like all of the political players, none of them mention the fact that the money that you're being forced to use, or the money that you've inherited from the status quo, because of it disintegrating in value, pushes you to buy those trainers today, not in a year's time. And that fact is the reason why there's so much consumption, which then leads on to, like, you know, credit card debt and household debt and all this kind of other stuff that's been productized around that incentive. What does Bitcoin mean from a perspective of the environment, and why are you excited about that?
So, man, it's such a touchy subject when we talk about climate change and environmental destruction. And so the one thing I will say is that there's a difference. We very frequently conflate environmental destruction and climate change. And I think the difference between those two things is that climate change is kind of the long changing patterns in our weather systems. And so temperature, frequency of kind of like severe events, you name it. Whereas environmental destruction is you can pollute waterways. You can put toxins directly into waterways that can kill off fish. You name it. You can also go and impact the air. You can put pollutants into the air. Smog creates acid rain. You can also go draw minerals out of the ground that impact our natural environment, the forests. And so being able to separate environmental destruction and climate change, I think, is the first thing that I tend to do, because I think that when we start going down this rabbit hole, the one thing we cannot deny is that we are impacting our environment. We are devastating our environment in so many different ways. And so that's the area, like from the book, I really wanted to kind of touch on, is that our consumption habits are devastating our natural environment, which in turn is impacting us as individuals. If you are putting tons of pollutants into the atmosphere, it's impacting our health. You just need to look at some of the studies of people living in some of these major cities versus people that live in the natural environment to see the difference in health. And so I would say that when we look at Bitcoin, if we are able to even just cut consumption by a small amount, we are going to start to see a huge impact, positive impact on our natural environment. But not only that, and as I mentioned, is that if you impact the flow of capital towards consumption companies, well, what you're also going to see a shift in is more competition, because obviously there's less capital going for those companies. Those companies are going to have to fight for those dollars. And when you see competition, you tend to see the quality of product increase. And so already in industries such as like the outdoor industry, people are very conscious about the companies at which they direct their capital towards. They're saying like Arc'teryx, you see Patagonia, you see these companies that said, look, we want to create amazing products that meet your needs, but we also want to do it sustainably. And so people are starting to be a lot more conscious about the quality of the product and how the product is being made. And so I think that as we start to increase competition in consumption, we're going to see obviously the quality of the product increase, and we start to see a decline in the impact on the natural environment. So I think, to me, that is absolutely massive. And one other thing I'll mention is that
it's huge.
Yeah. It's huge. And what I think is really interesting is that there's a guy called Michael Pettis, and he wrote a book, and I've completely blanked on the name of the book, and he talks about kind of the economy and money and supply chains. And he says that as we start to see central banking proliferate, and as we've seen the suppression of interest rates, because it's become easier for companies to borrow when you artificially suppress the cost of capital, we start to see supply chains lengthen. So the average product now touches 6 countries before it arrives on our doorstep. Wow. Think about like not just the resources that go into the actual creation of whatever that product is, but think about how much resources we used in just moving that product around the world. And so this is where I think that as we start to move towards a Bitcoin standard, you're starting to see people appreciate locally made products, whether it's locally made food, locally grown food, pasture raised animals. Basically, anything that is more locally produced or nationally made has just such a lower footprint on the impact on our natural environment. And yeah, I just think that is huge, because we have such a consumption-based society, and you just think about how much of this content just is being shipped across oceans back and forth and back and forth. And I used to work for a mountain bike company, and one of our competitors at the time made this carbon handlebar here in Vancouver. And this carbon handlebar, it was cheaper for them to ship the carbon handlebar after it was made to China to put the decal on for the handlebar and get it shipped back than it was to put the decal on in Canada. And I'm just like, that's just insane. That's just nuts. And so this is what I believe is a byproduct of an artificial cost of capital. If you allow people to borrow artificially low rates, they're able to do things they otherwise would not have been able to do. And so that, I think, that's one of the reasons why we have just unbelievable consumerism. That's why you can have a pineapple turn up at your doorstep from the grocery store for $3, yet that thing's been grown in Costa Rica. Someone's had to water it, spent a year. They've had to ship that thing halfway across the world, and you've just spent $3 on it. I'm just like, that is a result of broken money.
And it's all about incentive, essentially, isn't it? And you start to see these patterns where it's like, God, the incentives are broken over there. And oh my God, the incentives kind of work. Wow. This is like almost like a magic. It's such a big change. You're like, oh my gosh. And it's wild. I actually used to work in the shipping industry, not in the container market, which is where that handlebar would have traveled from Canada to China and back. But I was in the dry bulk space. We were moving iron ore, grain, coal, sand, cement, things like this in large quantities. And it's just wild, the amount of resource that is dug out of the ground, put on a ship, moved somewhere. The numbers are absolutely mind-blowing. But what I think caught my attention most about the Bitcoin thing is, like, in hindsight, climate change, quote-unquote, global warming, quote-unquote, they've become highly politicized mechanisms of control, in my opinion. Long-term resource management is absolutely a critical discussion. And of course, it makes sense, especially if you're having children, that you don't want to like use all the firewood today because someone's going to need the firewood in the future. And to not have a sense of responsibility for that it's anti-human. like on so many levels. Do you know what I mean? It's like, why would you do that? Obviously, you want to develop a space and harmony with the natural environment that ensures that your grandkids have something to actually live in. And that's what's such a that's at such polar opposite ends of what the current political system will tell you they are doing. You know what I mean? Trust us, we've got you. But then when we have these kind of conversations, it's like, this is a freaking joke, what's going on? You're making people use money that's like disintegrating, and therefore the behavior. Anyway, yeah, I mean, I don't want to rant too hard, but you're just like,
honestly, I could not agree more.
Intense.
And I couldn't agree more. And I think that I think humans many times, we're so incredible in many ways, and we've just done such amazing things when it comes to technology, innovation. But at the same time, I think we have a naivety around intervention. I think that we believe we can condense these complex adaptive systems down into these binary things. If we do this, this is the result. And the reality is that we're always going to have these unintended consequences. And I think this is what Bitcoin is one of the skills of Bitcoin is stepping back and recognizing that when we try to intervene, these unintended consequences can be devastating. And so a couple that have kind of really stood out to me, like the first one I'll mention is that during the, when was it? In the 1930s, 1940s, the government was like, okay, you know what? We've come out of World War I. We need to be able to support our populace. What are we going to do? We're going to subsidize grain production. We're going to subsidize grain production so they come in hot and they basically incentivize the growing of various wheat products and corn products. What ended up happening? You saw these major grain manufacturers blow up, Kellogg's, Quakers, all of these huge grain manufacturers, because there was this abundance and excess of grain. On top of that, you saw all of these more traditional farmers shift over from more traditional agricultural methods all the way over to, we're just going to produce grain because that's the best incentive right now that makes us the most money. Well, all of these Quakers, Kellogg's, they all suddenly had an abundance of grain, so they started to create things like high fructose corn syrup. They were able to create all of these processed foods that otherwise would not have existed without this abundance of grain. And then they also had all of this excess capital. With that excess capital, they started lobbying the government. They lobbied the FDA and they created the food pyramid. And they basically flipped our natural health diet from millions of years of eating predominantly animal-based with a few vegetables and fruits here and there and very little grain. They completely flipped it on its head and they said, saturated fats are bad. We shouldn't be eating animal products. And instead, we need to eat a predominantly grain-based diet. And since then, we have seen the rising rates of diabetes. We have seen the rising rates of health issues. We've seen the rising rates of basically anything under the sun, you name it, I would say stems from the fact that we're just ingesting unbelievably processed foods that are all predominantly grain-based. And there's a reason why you put grain and you feed grain to cattle, because it fattens up cattle. It allows them to produce more meat and more fat, but it's not healthy. It's not healthy in the slightest. And so you start to see these repercussions. Okay, we want to support the populace by intervening and basically subsidizing grain. And that's led to basically lobbying the changing of what we deem as healthy, and then to a whole heap of health byproducts. And then you also see it on things like, again, like the environmental energy side of things. During the, the start of the Ukraine war, we started to see like Germany was freaking struggling. Germany had shut down all its nuclear reactors. And so oil prices started to skyrocket. And so what did they do? They put a cap on oil prices. That's the dumbest thing you can do, is put a cap on oil prices, because what ends up happening is people that, if oil had actually been able to free float as to based on supply and demand, prices would rise. People that couldn't afford that oil would then have to be innovative and think up other ways. And that's how innovation and technology advances. But instead, by capping oil, you allow people that otherwise could not afford that oil to purchase that oil. So they've been disincentivized from being innovative and thinking about other ways to survive and thrive. And instead, you increase the demand on oil, even though there's not enough supply, which then means to more drastic measures. So then you're just trying to obtain oil from anyone. And then you're obtaining oil from basically nation states that have heinous humanitarian impacts. And so I would say that anytime you try and intervene on these grand scales, it leads to all of these unintended consequences.
And even the word intervention does trigger people, amusingly. But it's something that I have also begun to realize. It's far more frequent than you think. And this concept of a free market, like, what even is that? Seb, I keep these conversations to 1 hour. One day I'm going to have an in-person studio and we'll do 3-4 hours and all the rest of it. But awesome to learn from you today. Thank you so much for sharing your time. Where can people head if they want to reach out?
For sure. No, and again, Jake, I really appreciate your curiosity and I really appreciate the questions. I think you just have such a way with words and such a depth of knowledge. And so, yeah, I really enjoy these conversations. And so I would say people want to check out any of the content. We spoke a lot about this book, The Hidden Cost of Money. You can find that on Amazon and most other book places, I believe. I'm on Twitter at just Seb Bunny, and Bunny is B-U-N-N-E-Y. I have a blog and then Looking Glass Education, which is where I post a little bit of my stuff these days, but it's definitely fallen a little bit by the wayside. But we have a whole bunch of free resources that really just speak to the layperson. All of this content I want to make sure is for the blue collar, for the individual who doesn't necessarily have the academic background. And the one quick thing I'll mention is I never want price to be a barrier to someone's learning journey. And so if you can't afford the book and you're curious about reading it, reach out and I'll just send you the ebook for free.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, we had Daz on a couple of weeks ago. So he's the other half in many ways of the Looking Glass team. Yeah. And in some ways, what you've produced with that website, it's ageless information. You reach basically a bit of a kind of bulk knowledge base. It's like, well, if you get through this, you kind of get it. And then you can make decisions. And I think that comes across very well. Well, Seb, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Jake.